Recording live from the Hoban Law Group here in Denver, Colorado, I'm your host, Eric Singular. We're sitting alongside president and founder of the Hoban Law Group, Bob Hoban. Today we are talking about security and the cannabis industry. We are joined by founder and managing partner of Cannabis Security Experts, Derek Porter. Thank you. Derek, thank you for joining us today. How are you doing?
Thank you so much for having me. I am doing great. No major complaints considering the circumstances with our global pandemic right now. How are you?
Oh, we're hanging in there. And tell us, where are we talking to you from? Where are you located in the country?
Sure. I'm Denver metro area.
Us as well. And we just reached the end of the stay-at-home order for the state of Colorado. However, the Denver mayor has continued to enforce it for about another week or so. So life is slowly getting back to normal. But I don't know. Tell us, from a security standpoint, what are some trends or some things that you've noticed for dispensaries for the cannabis industry since this pandemic has begun?
Sure. So I think out of necessity, there has been an uptick in burglaries. Now, the burglaries with regards to on the cannabis side, not necessarily on the hemp side, but the cannabis side, rec and medicinal, probably ubiquitously throughout the nation, but definitely in Colorado, there's been an uptick because, well, the circumstances which have been conveyed with regards to the pandemic, I think that it's just a more of an opportunity. There are more people that are obviously out of work. Unemployment is at a record high. And I think that people are just doing it because they feel that they have to. Sometimes there are upticks in burglaries, and we get the notifications from the Marijuana Enforcement Division. You see it in the news. I'll get clientele that let me know, and there really isn't much of an explanation behind it. Sometimes it's middle of the summer, sometimes it's middle of the winter. I think this one is directly connected to the pandemic, that people are more hunkered down, there are less people out, and it's just a higher opportunity, especially if you're looking for something that has immense street value and you can sell very quickly for cash in order to get by. So that's what I'm seeing right now. That's what my clientele has been letting me know, and that's what my cohorts and my associates have been seeing as well.
So, Derek, do you see that as a reflection of the interruption of the black market or the illicit market supply chain? In other words, with these lockdown scenarios across the country, do you see that the folks that are actually going in and robbing these places are doing it to feed a black market or illicit market supply chain? Or, is there really no rhyme or reason to it?
I don't necessarily think that there is. I could speculate all day long with regards to the connection one way or the other. I just think it's more of an opportunity, and where there's opportunity for crime will typically occur. The break-ins will typically occur. And these are the ones that are oftentimes at night that we're seeing. We're not necessarily seeing the hold-up style burglaries, but definitely an increase with frequency at night. And I think, at the end of the day, on the black market, you still need to pay for it. Whereas with the break-ins, and if you can't afford it on the black market, then that's free product.
Well, this is such an interesting topic, definitely one that we haven't touched on the Hoban Minute, this, kind of where the security industry and the cannabis industry come together. Derek, will you speak a little bit about the unique challenges faced in this industry? I'm thinking about, transporting product, or, you think about the related banking issues that, for a number of years, companies had to transport huge amounts of cash here in the Denver metro area. How have we addressed, how have you worked to address all these challenges the industry has faced?
Sure, absolutely. So there, I could go on and on and on about that one, but the biggest punchline, if I had to sum it up in 2 minutes, I would say the best weapon and the greatest resource that I have that I convey to clients, quite frankly, is education. Because nine times out of 10, they're, well, I would say five out of five, and then the other five out of five, they're just seasoned business professionals. And then you get the oddballs that are not only seasoned business professionals, but they're also really great at growing a crop and selling it. But more often than not, the ones that are just excellent producers of product oftentimes don't consider risk factors with regards to security and the fact that they are growing something that has such immense street value. You know, you think about it, gosh, back in the 2014 in Colorado, when in the beginning days when the state went recreational, and a pound of good product, I think the recreational yield for that was something at the time, it was as high as $4,000. So if you think about it, to steal a pound of marijuana, that's a lot of value there. And a lot of these facilities do not necessarily have banking-like security or even, you know, very good security, even with the regulations and the mandates that are placed where they have to have it. So a lot of times the clients know what they want, but they don't necessarily know what they need. So there's a lot of consultation involved before you get to the dollar mark as to what should you spend, and here's why. It's really, you have to present the why first, because again, they really know what they want. They don't necessarily know what they need. And we are very much, I mean, gosh, look at the pandemic right now. We're a reactive society. We are not, we're very much not a proactive society. And oftentimes, clientele come to me after they've been burned. I would say probably 80% of the time they come to my companies after they've been burned, they've been victimized, and then they realize, okay, there was, you know, a security guard at a facility just down the road was shot and killed. My facility, there was a holdup, you know, with AR rifles, and they came in very aggressively, and I lost half my team because, you know, bud tenders and various employees are scared to death to come back. Or it was just the middle of the night scenario where no one was harmed, but, you know, they lost 500 pounds of product. It was after harvest and everything was processed and ready to rock and roll, and they were going to get it to their storefronts, and they were robbed the night prior. So it's always a reactive thing. But with that being said, it is always about educating the client to best arm themselves with the defenses that are necessary, both internal and external, to protect their business. And it's a lot different than many other industries, quite frankly, I think, because there's still a lot of individuals that are coming out of the dark, if you will, that don't know. They may know a lot about business, but they've been doing things under the radar for so many years, and now they're in a more legitimized space, and they have to think about factors like that, that if they're going to be out in the open and they're going to operate like a lot of other businesses and they have millions of dollars of the product behind their walls, then they have to really start thinking about how to be proactive in protecting it. So the bottom line, quite frankly, their best defense is good education on how to protect themselves, their people, and their assets.
Well, and you make a good point, too. You think about the fact that a wholesale pound of marijuana in a regulated state will go for, you know, $1,000 on the low end, or lower than that in bulk, and up to $2,000. But sure, to your point, you take that same material, you drive to the southeast, the northeast, to the suburbs of Chicago, and you're looking at $3,500 up to, I've heard, as high as $5,000 for Colorado bud from the regulated market, yeah, in places like Florida. But, you know, the security element of the industry is extremely interesting to me. Little story. I coached a group of boys in basketball from second grade all the way till they were eighth graders. And one of the parents was a high-ranking official in our Denver FBI office. And I coached his son. Mm-hmm. His son was a heck of a player. And he found out, you know, he knew I was a lawyer, and then he kind of found out what kind of law I practiced, and, you know, kind of gave me this stern talking to. And I'm sitting here thinking, well, oh my goodness, you know, I'm a basketball coach. I'm teaching your son how to play basketball. Mm-hmm. By the way, we won 3 championships in a row early on with these kids running high school offenses, and these kids are all still playing high level basketball. But I remember, never forget the day he pulls me aside one day after practice, and he says, "Hey, Bob." I said, "What's going on?" He says, I'm about to retire. I'm 2 weeks out from retirement. What's this cannabis industry all about? I'd like to get into the security element of it." So, you know, it begs the question of what kind of folks get into the security element, what kind of backgrounds you bring to the table, and sort of how that helps shape this, especially when you look at this industry from afar as something that was just, you know, criminal through and through. In terms of, you know, it's legal treatment and coming out of the shadows. Give us a little perspective about your background and how you approach this industry. And just talk a little bit about, you know, what the profile of security personnel in this industry looks like.
Certainly. Yeah. And that's interesting, too. You know, the FBI agent he's, you know, technically retired, and they're looking to do something else to make some money. And to touch on my background, so I'm military, the executive protection space, and then hung my own, this is really the super fast forward version, hung my own shingle, and really just wanted to do a lot of consultation. And then a cohort of mine in Colorado, this was early 2012, he had reached out to me and said, "Hey, I got a client. I need a risk and vulnerability assessment done." He knew that I had had formal training in my master's program to do just that, a legitimate risk and vulnerability assessment, whether it's a small business or a Fortune 5. And I said, "Yes, absolutely. Sign me up. I'm looking for the work anyways." I actually didn't know until I arrived at the address to meet the client that it was a marijuana operation in Boulder. And of course, everything at that time was still just medicinal. So I had dove into that and we got the job done. And as I was learning the first couple of days, I actually had no idea. I was very ignorant to the industry. I had no idea, one, how prominent it was and how it was actually helping people from a medicinal standpoint. I'm a firm believer in that. But also, I didn't realize that there were mandates behind the security. I didn't know there were regulations behind it to where they had to have, you know, such and such LLC had to have X, Y, and Z security measures in place. And I said, "Really? They legally have to have it?" And my cohort at the time was like, "Yes. Do you see the potential here now?" And I said, "Yep, I do. I'm in." And actually completely reoriented my business to aim at the industry. And then out of sheer demand, we just expanded and expanded and expanded from beyond compensation into transport, into guards, into systems integration, so on and so forth, and just been hooking and jabbing since then. Now we've been with multiple companies. To touch on the other point, your other question with regards to what the profiles look like, I would say it's definitely heavily veteran-based, probably because it's new. You know, marijuana, especially when you go look at and talk to other people in different states where they don't have much of a program yet, or they're not quite recreational yet. Marijuana industry right now, you know, even hemp and just cannabis as a whole, it's sexy. And there's an appeal there. And then when they find out that there's that high risk, then there's the guard appeal, and you got a lot of, you know, former gun toting individuals coming out of the veteran woodwork. There's a lot of, you know, from the 3 wars, the war on terrorism, war in Afghanistan, war in Iraq. You got a lot of veterans that are coming out that have aggressive training, combat veteran experience, and they want to do something that is at least somewhat related to what they're doing. They may still want to go to school part-time or full-time while they're doing it, or they want to be a cop. Or if they want to stay something oriented to the industry where they get to carry a firearm. And oftentimes that can correlate and lead to an industry like this. So I'd say definitely a heavily veteran focus. You do get some law enforcement there, some moonlighting cops, if you will. But there's definitely a lot of conflict of interest there, of course, with their departments and so forth. So there's little of that. And then occasionally, like you said, Bob, there's the occasional, retired FBI individual or retired NSA or whatever the case may be. They have a lot of experience in not only the guard aspects, the gun-toting aspects, but there's a lot of investigative industry experience there, consulting and intelligence industry experience there. And you can find a way to tie that to the industry and present immense value to cannabis clientele. Does that make sense?
It absolutely does. And you know, that value it is reflected, too, in how some of the applications for licensing are evaluated. When you apply for a license to be a regulated business, of course, a significant portion, or at least a large portion of it, would be around security plan and security design for the facility to be compliant with the regulations. And when you evaluate those plans, it's important to have an element of pedigree, if you will, attached to the folks that are preparing those security plans. Someone that has the background and the experience, not just someone that says, you know, hey, I come from within the cannabis industry and I can do a great job at security. They might, but to have that outside experience really makes a difference, to your point.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you know, the deep education, oftentimes the consulting and so forth, that is all very relevant to your point. I with great pride, I sit on a little over a dozen advisory boards for several of my clients, purely for the fact that in a lot of the different states, they require, for the license procurement stages, they require manifestation of an advisory board. And oftentimes, there is a requirement for a subject matter expert on, you know, cultivation or this or that and security. So, you know, I'm able to charge a retainer for that, and I'll sit on the board for increments of 1 year at a time. And then, you know, even back to that original point with regards to application writing and so forth, some of the security plans, which are scored very, very highly in the license procurement stages with a lot of newcomer clientele, you know, they have to be very elaborate. Some Canada, their application is extremely cumbersome. Pennsylvania was another direct example when they did their round one, and when they only issued four licenses initially. I had to shut my door for days. We had one Pennsylvania client. I'd shut my door for days and write and write and write and write so that my security knowledge became relevant in a technical writing sense with regards to the industry, which is something that I would have never predicted years ago. And I know a lot of people that work in the security industry in different areas and touching other industries that would have never had any idea.
Another question for you, Derek, as you look at, I don't know if, you know, we can call the Colorado cannabis industry a more mature market than let's say the market that just emerged in Illinois with it coming online in January. Mm-hmm. But do you see, what are some of the differences you see from a security perspective for a market like Colorado? You know, as we touched on earlier, in the early days of legalization, everything was a cash transaction. That has now evolved a little bit. But just interested in some of those, you know, either state-by-state differences or even regional differences.
Certainly, yeah. I actually just had a conversation earlier on the phone today about this. There are differences state to state, sometimes county to county, and sometimes city to city. So as you mentioned, let's talk about Colorado and even Illinois, for example. So for the longest time, and I think even still right now, there was no license cap, whereas Illinois has license caps in different rounds and in different phases. There was a very relaxed application and relaxed writings to the tune of the license procurement phases for the security plan for Colorado versus Illinois. There's definitely a maximum page limit. I think it was 65 pages, whether it was med or rec, whichever stage in the arena where you're applying. but there's a lot more writing and a lot more information that needs to be conveyed there. And gosh, there's some places like Los Angeles. I don't know if this is still in place, but for several years, California has definitely got decent regulations. They're not too terribly strict, but Los Angeles itself actually has some pretty strict regulations. You actually have to have guards there. And a lot of other cities and various other states, you have to have guards. So now a main difference there is when you're creating the barriers to entry with license caps, now it's made the best application win. So whatever team is behind that application needs to really, you know, have it together. They're oftentimes very, I like to say, moneyed. So they have to bring some dollars to the table to pay professionals and experts like ourselves and a lot of the people that you've interviewed on your show to, you know, bring the heavy guns and be able to hook and jab in that arena in order to procure the license. But in addition to that, gosh, some of the principal differences there is there's going to be heavier regulations because they're trying to squeeze it tighter so that it's a more difficult process in order to win their license, if you will. So a lot of times the barriers to entry can be good, at least from my viewpoint, from a security standpoint, because it makes regulations more strict and the client in many respects is forced to spend heavier dollars into security. And then, of course, because there's more value there, because it was so hard to retain that license, they want to really protect that operation. So they oftentimes pour more dollars into it. So it's highly variable. It is definitely state by state, country by country even. And it's really just all over the board. They definitely have some more lucrative experiences and even more pleasurable experiences in different states, different counties, different cities than others, if that all makes sense.
Oh, it absolutely does. And, you know, Derek, you made a great point when you said that a lot of the profiles or the backgrounds of security personnel in this industry, they are veterans. Will you talk a little bit about some of your non-cannabis related veteran work? I know you're doing some interesting things and some really valuable things for that population.
Certainly, yeah. So I actually sit on the board of a 501c3 called Sierra Delta, which is a nonprofit for veterans that provides service dogs for veterans. Another one of my companies, Dynamic Warriors, we sell some CBD products and a percentage of one of the dog products. Actually, the proceeds for that, a percentage of that goes to Sierra Delta. So when you donate to an organization like that, you actually help out two different species. You help out humans, veterans specifically, which are their own species right there, and you help out dogs. So it's really a phenomenal application there. It's really a phenomenal organization. And even previously beyond that, a handful of my cohorts a few years back started another 501c3 called the War Raiders Campaign, which is actually one that we gave the ability for various what we call warriors to be able to write their experiences by way of narrative, whether it was a full-blown book or a short story, and tell their experiences as survivors, as combat veterans, as, you know, the veteran wife or the veteran son or daughter. And the money that was raised in purchasing those stories, whether you downloaded it to your Kindle or your iPad or you bought the book, all of that money went to mental health, best-in-class mental health organizations. So that was really helpful. It allowed veterans to immortalize their stories in addition to raise funds for mental health. And I've tried to get involved as much as I can, philanthropically with various different organizations, but there usually is always some sort of a veteran tie just because it's so near and dear to me, being a veteran myself.
No, we really applaud all of that. That's such a valuable work that you're doing, and it's really interesting how all of this ties together. The nonprofit work you're doing and providing this is a great job. The cannabis security industry is a perfect path for veterans as well. Derek, this is a very valuable topic, and we thank you for coming on to the Hoban Minute and downloading it with us. Bob, anything you want to touch on before we sign off?
Derek, you've said it all. Thanks for joining us today, and we look forward to connecting in person very soon.
Absolutely. Gentlemen, thank you so very much. I was honored to be on your show, and I will see you soon. Thanks again.
Take care, Derek. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of the Hoban Minute special series on coronavirus and cannabis. You can head on over to hoban.law for more information on this podcast or the Hoban Law Group. If you have any ideas for subjects that we should be covering or any questions you want to pose to Bob or myself, shoot us an email at media@hoban.law. And stay tuned for the next episode on this special series, Coronavirus and Cannabis.